This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
This week on Into the Archives with the Boone Podcast, one of my favorite people, not teammates, not ball players, one of my favorite people that I've ever spent time with in my life. He was a great hitter, great teammate, just a great man, and won a couple World Series with the Toronto Blue Jays. We were teammates for 4 years in Seattle, John Olerud.
Sometimes you just need to enjoy a classic.
Join us as we go into the archives.
Hey, we going back.
And put our ear to the history books with this one.
This is Into the Archives. Here's your host, Brett Boone.
Big Rude, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Brett. Nice to be on here.
I know you're overly excited to be on, but we were talking. I was talking to Cameron, Mike Cameron, the other day, and I said, because Mike came on the podcast, and I said, we got to get Big Rude. No one ever hears from Big Rude, and that's when I gave you a call. We had a chat, and it's great to catch up. All right, on the Boone Podcast, we like to find out everything. And I know Johnny the Adult, my first baseman. I want to know about you as a kid growing up. I know your pops was a ball player, Dr. Olerud, Washington State, College World Series hero, ended up signing with the Angels eventually. Tell me all about your childhood growing up.
Yeah, my dad, you know, I got to watch him play. I mean, I was real young when he was playing. And so he stopped playing when I was about four and then became a doctor. And, you know, for my dad and I, that was something that we'd always do to have fun is we'd go out and we'd take batting practice. We'd play catch, do that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it was really, I couldn't have had a better dad, you know, if I wanted to be a professional ball player, because not only did was he a catcher, which, you know, quarterback of the whole team, knows everything that's going on. Also he was a doctor, and so he kept me in shape, you know, protected my arm and, all that sort of stuff. So he could, fix me up if I got hurt, and also was a great mentor in, getting me through, you know, all my baseball activities.
So Johnny, growing up, Bellevue, Washington, is that right?
Yep. Actually we were Seattle, but real close
to Bellevue. Okay. And growing up, I know you played hoops in high school. I know you were a golfer, along with being a baseball player, but was baseball it for you? Is that what you always wanted to do as a kid?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I did a lot of other sports. I did soccer, and basketball, you know, and soccer, you know, that was fun until everybody else could run faster than you. And, you know, you couldn't catch anybody and everybody ran you down immediately. You know, basketball, I was a late grower, so I didn't really start growing until my sophomore year in high school. And I just had a bad year, you know, just one of those embarrassing years where you just couldn't make a shot, you couldn't make a layup, and you just said, I just said, basketball's not for me. And I would just have fun playing in the, you know, the driveway with friends, lowering the hoop so that I could dunk on it and that kind of thing. I played golf. Golf was, I liked golf, but no matter how much I played, I was always the fifth man on the golf team. And so just couldn't seem to get better, kind of plateaued there. So yeah, you know, outside of golf, baseball was really the sport that I, you know, stuck with and enjoyed the most.
All right, so we get to your I want to talk about this. I'm interested in the golf. You know, Rude, when we were growing up, guys our age, being on the golf team wasn't that cool. Now it's really – Tiger made it really cool to be a golfer. I had a couple buddies that were on the golf team, and we'd tease them, you know, because they'd finish finish school, and they had to go out to their nine-hole match. Nowadays, golf's a little – have you been playing you've been playing recently?
I haven't been playing much recently, but yes, golf was not cool when I was playing, but I felt like I had a chance to get a Letterman's jacket playing golf. And so as long as nobody looked too closely at, you know, what I lettered in, you know, felt pretty good walking around the campus.
All right. So in 86, let's get to the baseball portion. In 86, you're a 27th round pick with the Mets. You end up going to Washington State, following in your dad's footsteps. And your freshman year, you just decide you're going to pitch and you're going to hit. You hit 414 and you go 8-2. So was Washington State and you know, we'll get to it a little later in the podcast. That's where I had my first encounter with Johnny Olerud a year later in the Alaska League. But was college all you seem not to struggle right out of the gates. Was college all you expected?
Washington State. I got recruited by University of Washington State, and I don't know how, but Stanford, recruited me, but they only wanted me to pitch. And Washington State and University of Washington said that they'd let me do both, pitch and hit. So, you know, at the time, Washington State was the best program in the state. And Bobo Brayton, the coach, was, you know, he had, you know, just a legendary, you know, coaching career. And he coached my dad. So my dad was his first recruiting class. So I kind of knew Washington State baseball. And so I went there and they let me pitch and play first base. And as far as the adjustment, I think the adjustment went well. I think there's something to be said about being on a good team that has a lot of tradition. There was just expectations. There was a lot of pressure to excel and win ball games. And, Bobo, he hated losing. And, he put the fear of God in you when you went out there. You know, there were definitely expectations. But it was a great experience. Had a great time at Washington State.
So for those people out there listening to the Boone podcast, Johnny's a year older than me, so his sophomore year is my freshman year. My freshman year, I go to the Alaska League, and Washington State happens to be in our league, and we come down to Pullman, and we played you guys. I remember Bobo. I can remember him vividly with the helmet on. And I remember coming into Washington State, and this is coming off your sophomore year. You hit 464 and you go 15-0 on the bump. And the legend of Johnny Olerud was growing, because at the time we didn't know one another, but everybody was talking about this guy, Johnny Olerud, he could really hit and he could pitch too. And I remember coming and I remember talking to your teammates. And we've got a couple stories we're going to cover here today on the Boone podcast. Here's the first one. Your teammates that year I was on the Alaska Goaltenders. We come over and we're talking, hey, yeah, this John Olerud guy, oh yeah, he's really good. One of the kids says to me, he goes, Booney, I played with Johnny all year this year. I didn't see him swing and miss a pitch once. Now, the college season is 60 to 70 games. Rude, are you going to sit here today and say that your sophomore year in college, you didn't swing and miss a pitch? Or is that just is that a legendary tall tale?
I got to believe it's a legendary tall tale. You know, as you get further and further away from playing, the stories just get better and better, which I don't mind. But that's a good story. I would like to believe it's true, but it's hard for me to believe that's true. But that year was just one of those years where everything went right. It was hitting the ball hard, and it was never at anybody. You hit something bad, it fell in. Pitching, I remember one game that year I went 15-0, and one of the games I had a horrible first inning, gave up 4 runs in the first inning, but we had a great team, and so they came back, we scored, we'd score about 8 to 10 runs every time I went out on the hill there. So it was just super fun year, and just everything went right. So
okay, so serious subject, and this is something that kind of changed your life forever. Prior to your junior year, you collapsed while jogging.
Yeah.
What transpired? Tell me the story. What happened? And that was the very beginning for you. What happened that day?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to go back, just before we went for Christmas break, Bobo wanted to do some testing to see, where we were at before we went for Christmas break, and wanted to test this when we got back to see if we, did a good job over Christmas break staying in shape. So I remember we were doing these plyometric box jumps where you'd have to jump on top of the box to the other side, back and forth, as many as you could do in 90 seconds. And then at the end, sprint like you're running to first base. And I got done with that, and I remember I had the worst headache I had ever had. Couldn't see straight. My headache was so bad. And I remember talking to my roommate and told him about it. And he says, oh, you probably just weren't getting enough oxygen. You weren't breathing, and that's what gave you a headache. So, all right. So the next week we did the same thing again. I really concentrated on breathing. I had the bad headache again, but it didn't last as long. So I figure that's got to be it. I just got to concentrate on breathing when I'm, doing the strenuous exercise. So I go home for Christmas break. I don't work out like I should. I don't run like I, should. And I come back, we do our workout, 6 a.m. weight training workout, and I grab Quentin Poyle, who was an outfielder for us. And I said, hey, let's go run the time mile because, kind of wanted to do a crash course in getting in shape. And so I ran about 3/4 of a mile as hard as I could. And I had, I got done because I couldn't finish. So I started walking it off and I got the bad headache again. And the last thing I remember was looking down at my feet and saying, gosh, what's the deal with these headaches? And that's the last thing I remember. I guess what happened, what people told me was that I had a grand mal seizure. They took me to the Pullman Hospital. They tried to figure out what was going on. My heart and stuff didn't stabilize. So my dad, he flew over. He was there when I was in Pullman. And then they flew me to Sacred Heart Hospital in Spokane. And they started working me up, trying to figure out what was going on. So it wasn't any, they did drug testing, screening, all this sort of stuff. And when they finally did a spinal tap, that's when they saw a lot of blood in my spinal column. And they knew that I had had some sort of bleed in my head spinal column area. And so that's when they started looking for an aneurysm. So when I was in Spokane, they didn't find the aneurysm. So they sent me back to Washington State. And they said, hey, first 2 weeks, just take it easy. You know, don't do anything strenuous. The third week, you can start playing catch and hitting again. And then the fourth week, you can start running and start trying to get back into shape. So my dad, he wasn't satisfied with the study, or I mean, he just wanted to have an answer, and we didn't have an answer. So he sent the studies to Dr. Nguyen here in Seattle. And he wanted to do another study to get a different x-ray, because you have to get the right angle on the aneurysm to see it. So so he wanted to take a few more x-rays. So I come back right as I'm getting ready to start running again. And I just remember I was really upset with my dad, because, you know, it was a big year for me. It's your junior year. You know, I had just coming off the sophomore year that was just a phenomenal year, and I knew this was a big year for me. So I thought, gosh, Dad, you're killing me by being this cautious. There's nothing wrong with me. They're not going to find anything. But I came back. We did another angiogram to do the x-rays that they wanted to do it, and I still remember the doctor putting the x-rays up on the screen, and I could see the aneurysm. It was just the right angle, and I could see the aneurysm. So after that, 3 days later, they have me scheduled for surgery to put a clip on the aneurysm. And so surgery went well. February 27th, I had the surgery, and the surgery went well. And I was able to come back before the 6 to 8 weeks that it takes for bone to heal. So, you know, they wanted me to wear a helmet to protect against getting hit and doing damage, you know, to the, you know, where they cut the chunk of skull out to put the clip on. So I came back about 6 weeks after surgery, and was DHing. I wasn't 100%, you know, you think I was slow when you played with me. You should have seen me, you know, when I first came back. I was really slow, painfully slow, but I was back. So, and then it was just a process of, trying to get stronger, trying to get back into shape. And so, yeah, I think I was back middle of April was when I came back. And then the June draft comes pretty quick after that, and everybody was asking me, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to sign? I'm thinking, gosh, you know, I just came back from this surgery. I'm just happy to be back. I don't see myself signing in the June draft. So I told people that I wasn't going to sign, and tried to discourage teams from wasting a draft pick on me. I figured I would go back to school and come out after my senior year. The Blue Jays drafted me in the third round, and they watched me play all summer in the Alaska League. And then just before I went back to school in August, that's when they signed me.
So the baseball aside, how did the events that transpired, did that change your life, your personal life on a day-to-day basis? Did you have to change anything, or it was just once I got stronger, got my strength back, life went back to, you know, normal as we know it? You started wearing that helmet after your junior year, and kind of, you know, as your career progressed, everybody knew Big Root is the guy that wore the helmet in the field. And I don't know that everybody knew the story. They definitely didn't know the story as in depth as you just told it. But how did that affect your personal life and how you had to take care of yourself, or did it at all?
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with The Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Well, I think, as you look at it, I mean, looking back, you know, I was young, I was 20 years old at the time. And I just thought, you know, I'm in good health. I take care of myself. You know, a health problem is not going to happen to me. And so I think that, that really affected me, you know, moving forward as far as, you know, boy, you can't assume things are going to happen a certain way. Things aren't in control of things as much as you think you're in control of things. I thought if I just, you know, didn't do anything stupid, you know, just continued on, that I would be around into my 60s, 70s. So this was a big shock to me. And I think that, you know, played a big part in me, you know, coming to faith, coming to know Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior later. But at the time, Dr. Nguyen, he told me after the surgery, you know, that he put a clip on the aneurysm, he cauterized it, you know, he secured the vessel up there. He says, you know, you're better now than before the surgery, because now, you know, we've done a full scan of your, you know, whole head area, and you don't have any other aneurysms, and the one that you do have has been repaired. So he said, you don't need to worry about going forward. It's all about getting your strength back. And he just wanted me to wear a helmet to protect the place that they went in to do the surgery.
Okay, so your junior year, and you had mentioned you got drafted in the third round by the Toronto Blue Jays. You hit 359 that year. 359 after coming off that unbelievable sophomore season, but 359 with everything you were dealing with probably wasn't that, awful of an average to hit for that year. But you mentioned the helmet. It seems like a perfect time for my favorite story. I'll try to set it up, Rude, as good as I can. You tell me the, where I'm accurate and if there's any inaccuracies. But those of you listening to the Boone podcast out there, there's a legendary story about John Olerud amongst Major League Baseball players, especially the time we were playing. And it was Johnny's in Toronto, and Ricky Henderson is he's a sign at the deadline for their playoff and World Series run. So Johnny and Ricky Henderson are teammates, and everybody kind of knows Ricky's personality. Ricky talks in the third person, and from what I hear, I never had the pleasure of being a teammate of his, but I heard he was a great teammate and just a fun guy. Yeah. And let's be honest, Ricky's Ricky. So they finish it out. Johnny eventually later in his career goes to the New York Mets. And once again, Ricky's nearing the end of his career. And he's another kind of what they call a rental player for the Mets for their postseason run. And as the legendary story goes, and Ricky comes up to John Olerud as a Met teammate and says, "Hey, man, you remind me of a guy I played with in Toronto." And it's such a Ricky that you'd expect story. And before Johnny and I became teammates, that story would go around. And I told you the story one day in Seattle when we just had some time. And you looked at me and you said, "Booney, it's a great story and I wish it was true, but it's not." How many times have you been told that story and you have to disappoint that it's not a real story?
Yeah. All the time. And it keeps going on. And, you know, it's funny, people will come up that have no interest in baseball and they'll come up and they'll go, "Hey, my neighbor wanted me to ask you a question." If they're not a baseball person and their neighbor asks them a question, 9 times out of 10, it's the Ricky Henderson story. But I get asked that all the time. I got asked that, when I was with the Red Sox. I remember sitting in the food room and somebody's looking at me and he goes, "Can I ask you a question?" And here it comes again, the Ricky Henderson story. I played with Ricky with the Blue Jays, and I played with him in the Mets. And actually, the story came out when I was with the Mariners. And the first I heard about it, Dave Niehaus walks up to me and he's kind of chuckling and he says, "Hey, tell me if this is true. They say Ricky came up to you to ask you why you wear the helmet. And you said, 'Well, I had surgery, you know, when I was in college and I've just been wearing it ever since.'" And he said, "You know what? I played with a guy like that in the Mets." And he goes, "Is that true?" And I said, "Wow, that's good. I like that. But no, that's not true." You know, because Ricky, he's known for not remembering people's names. You know, he'd just always call you big man or, you know, "Hey, dude," you know, or, you know, just he'd call you a nickname. He wouldn't call you by your name. So the real story about what happened was with the Mets, we had an assistant trainer, Scott Lorenzen, and he had just a great sense of humor, very dry. And one of the things he liked to do was he would see a picture in a magazine or a newspaper that looked like one of the guys on the team. And he'd cut it out. And he'd make up a little story underneath, you know, so-and-so was seen on an off day, you know, whatever, that would kind of fit the picture on the paper. So it was always fun to go into the training room and see what was on the bulletin board or if there was any new material. I remember one time, you know, he did a thing on what guys would be doing if they weren't playing professional baseball. And he had me down as I'd be a Walmart greeter. just because, you know, I wasn't very talkative. So he thought that would be funny, me, you know, having to greet people. But so anyway, so he came up with the story when he found out that Ricky got picked up by Seattle after the Mets released him. He told the story. The clubhouse guys thought that was funny. They go out into the clubhouse and they start telling some of the guys. And there's always reporters in the clubhouse and somebody must have picked up on it. They wrote about it. Then the broadcasters, you know, doing the TV broadcast, they read about it. So they talk about it and it just kind of took on a life of its own. And I think eventually, you know, a lot of guys from the Mets, I hear, you know, they reported it on SportsCenter and, you know, the whole room just broke up laughing. So, yeah,
I still laugh about it.
And it's got a life of its own. Yeah.
It's funny, though, because if your name ever comes up and, yeah, Johnny was teammate of mine, you know, everybody knows we were teammates and I'll get it, too. You know, not even being John Olerud, but they'll go, "Hey, Booney, is it true that this is what Ricky said to John?" And I just start laughing. Yeah. And I, you know, because you get to a point where you don't want to tell them it's not true because it's such a good story. But I couldn't imagine how many times you'd have to say, "No, that's not true. It's not true. It's not true."
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway.
Yeah. So no, it's not true. But I mean, it's like I said, you know, it's such a good story. People are probably going to use it to open up with their speeches or, you know, that sort of thing.
As we get older, Johnny, you should just say, you know what? Damn it. It is true. That's right. I lied for all these years. It's a great story.
That's right.
All right. So we get back to the draft. You drafted in the third round, as you said. You were telling the scouts and the organization said, "Hey, I'm probably not going to sign. I want to be in the room because this is something we've talked about at length, and I'll expand on it later in your Boston years at the end of your career." But you went straight to the big leagues. Now, for those people out there listening to the podcast, this is a very rare thing. So and you sign in was it 89? Yeah, you sign in 89. Like you said, you went out and you played summer ball. You end up signing with the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, we're talking about Bob Horner went straight to the big leagues. Dave Winfield, as I can remember, Pete Incaviglia did it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a few others there, but this is such a rare thing. The best of the best usually don't get this opportunity. Tell me what it was like negotiating that contract and saying, "Oh yeah, Toronto. And by the way, I'm not going to the minor leagues. I go straight to the big leagues." And I know John Olerud wouldn't talk like that, but take me inside that negotiation. And if that was at the forefront, that's one of the demands you guys had if they were going to sway you away from your senior year.
No. Yeah. Well, I would say, honestly, the only way I go straight to the big leagues after being drafted is by having the aneurysm surgery like I did. Because here's what happened. We get drafted. I'm telling everybody I'm not going to sign. I'm not going to sign. So don't waste a draft pick on me. The Blue Jays draft me in the third round and, right, that's fine. I appreciate it, but, you know, I'm not going to sign. I've been telling everybody I'm not going to sign. So they watch me all summer play in the Alaska League. And, you know, as I get further and further away from the surgery and I get stronger and I'm more able to play and start getting more back to normal, they watch me and I go and I play in the National Baseball in Wichita. Doggone it.
I remember.
Yeah. And I go back and I play in that and I get done. And so, they didn't even start negotiating with me or talking contract until, the end of August after the summer season was over. So it's a week before I go back to Washington State. That's when they started talking to me. So the fact that they didn't start talking to me about contracts and that sort of stuff until the end of August, you know, at that point, you know, yes, they were talking, you know, contract terms and Ben McDonald, you know, he was the number one guy. So, you know, they were, you know, trying to be somewhere where Ben McDonald was. But the fact that they did offer to have me be a September call-up in September. And so this is a week, it was about a week or two away from September. And at that time, the Blue Jays were in a pennant race against Baltimore. The Sky Dome, they had just opened up. So I think they opened up in July of that year. And so it was brand new with the self-closing roof and everything. And, you know, I was still stuck in my head thinking, you know, I committed to my team that I was going to come back. But, you know, the thing that kind of pushed me over the edge is I remember my dad saying, "Well, you know, there's been a lot of great players that have never had a chance to experience what it's like, you know, coming down the last month of the pennant race." And so that was kind of one of the things that that kind of pushed me over the edge. My dad was trying not to influence me at all. And, you know, I wanted, I wanted somebody else to make the decision for me. But I would say, honestly, I was telling everybody I was going to go back to school. So, that was one of the things that put me over the edge, is that experience of being in a pennant race, and being up with the big league club. But, it was a September call up. And if I would have, been completely healthy and 100%, on my junior year, I would have signed in June. And in June, it's a completely different story. You're not going to take a roster spot, you know, from somebody, especially a position player. Maybe if you're a pitcher that, you know, is just a dominant pitcher, they may do that, but not a position player. It was just the way things worked, was just perfect for that. Then the following year, spring training, they had the lockout. So it was a shortened, spring training in 90. And so then they expanded the rosters, because they didn't want their pitchers to get hurt. And so it was a 27-man roster in 90, to start the year, the first month of the season. And so they brought me along for that first month. And so then when they reduced the rosters, they didn't go back to the 24-man roster. They went down to a 25-man roster. And so they kept me along for that season. So I was, you know, back up to Fred McGriff and DHing.
Well, you know, and I expect you to be, because the John Oliver I know is as humble as anybody that I do know. So I expect you to explain it that way. But I just want to explain for people out there how special that is to go to the big leagues, never return. They could have done whatever they wanted.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like Johnny needs some seasoning. Yeah. He needs to go to AA, whatever. They didn't. So I know you made a good enough impression on them to say they probably knew at that point, John Olerud's our future at first base, but to keep you on the roster and say, no, we're going to keep him, and then we're going to keep him again. And it's nice that you say, well, it was a 27-man roster, so I got lucky. I just want to explain to people how special of a player you were coming out of college, and you were. Okay, so you mentioned the Sky Dome is brand new. I remember, and by the way, while you were at the Sky Dome, I was in Peninsula, Virginia, living with six people. My first bedroom was the couch, but Rude, we'll get to that later. Don't worry about it. But you mentioned Sky Dome, and I remember those teams. You know, I remember being in the minor leagues watching you guys, and 92, 93, you win the World Series back to back. Joe Carter hits the huge homer. Robbie Alomar is your second baseman. That's a guy I really looked up to at the time, being a second baseman. Sky Dome was brand new. It was a buzz. I mean, what was it like those years playing in Toronto? Was it as electric as it looked like it was?
Yeah, it was. It was that electric. The stadium was sold out every home game. Every home game. And you went around town, and that was just such a big deal. The Blue Jays were such a big deal that, you know, you went around town and people would recognize guys. You know, I mean, we had these team cars, you know, that had a Blue Jay on the sign. So you kind of stuck out, you know, driving around the team car. But, they were fanatical for their team. And it was super fun to be a part of the team at that time, for sure.
So you come up in 90. You get your feet wet. You're starting to play. You're playing good enough to stay. But in 93 is really your breakout season. It kind of puts you on the map.
Yeah.
And you win the batting title. You hit 363. You drive in 100 runs for the first time. You're an all-star. And you win the World Series. And that's coming off a 92 World Series victory back-to-back. Was there a better year in your career than that year? I'd be hard pressed to say that's the pinnacle.
Yeah, no, No, that was my best year without a doubt. It was, again, it was like, you know, that year in college where just everything went right. Gosh, I was in such a good, spot hitting wise. I felt like pitchers couldn't beat me, on the inside part of the plate. And, you know, if they threw it away, that's where I just was at my best, was the ball middle away. And could, you know, just felt like I could handle everything, was, wasn't fooled by off speed pitches. I was just felt like I was on everything. And then, you know, you hit the ball hard, it drops in, you hit the ball, off center and it still drops in. I remember, our bullpen coach, we were playing in Minnesota and it was, I think sold out, and I, you know, am late on a fastball and I hit a line drive, into the stands, you know, where it could have killed somebody, but, you know, it hits this seat, this empty seat. And so he's talking about that afterwards. How about Ole? You know, all season long, he hits it into a big crowd of people and he hits the one empty seat. How's he doing? You know, staying hot. So that was the type of year where it was just, you know, everything went right. And, you know, we had Robbie Alomar on the team and Paul Molitor and Joe Carter and Devon White. And I mean, we just had a lineup that, you know, it's not, you know, they weren't going to pitch around me because there was, you know, so many guys that could hurt you. So, yeah, it was an amazing year. It was the type of year that you compared all other years to, you know, you had a good year with the Mets, but I still think that, you know, the 93 was better. I just was more, just hit the ball hard more often than I did with the Mets. But the Mets, I had a great year with them as well.
Well, looking at it, I don't think you had a bad year with the Mets. You go from after the 96 season, you go to the Mets. You're there from 97 to 99. 98, you hit 354. You just missed. I think it came down to one of the last games of the season, and I believe Larry Walker beat you out. But you hit 354 there. Your 3 years with the Mets were tremendous. How was it going from Canada, Toronto, Sky Dome, and now you're headed to the Big Apple? What was that like for you?
Well, I mean, I'm coming from Toronto where I signed a big contract with Toronto after the 93 year. And then I struggled. I struggled the next, 3 years really. And, I get towards the end of my contract and, they trade me to the Mets. So I'm struggling as I come to the Mets. But you know, I would say, visiting New York, it was always such an intimidating place. And I heard so many stories, about, you know, what a tough place New York can be to play. So I would say I was anxious, you know, coming to the team. It's the first time I'd ever switched teams. I would say I was anxious, but boy, what a great experience I had in New York. Totally exceeded all my expectations. Great guys in the clubhouse, really enjoyed the coaching staff, and you know, the fans always treated me good. Now I think that the fans treated me good because there wasn't the expectations of me coming in. I think, you know, when I came in, it was kind of like, gosh, is this guy on his way out? You know, why'd we get this guy? As opposed to Mike Piazza coming. And I remember when Mike Piazza came, and if there was a guy on second base and he didn't drive him in, you know, he would get booed. You know, the expectations were, was he was going to hit a home run every time up at the plate. And so I think, you know, the expectations helped me, you know, with New York, but the New York fans always treated me great.
Yeah, and you mentioned expectations. It is, and it's a real thing. I mean, I'm sure you felt a little bit of that after the 93 season. You know, if you come back and just have a normal year and hit 310, everybody's going, what's wrong with Olerud? And you're like, exactly. Well, 310's pretty good, isn't it? No, we're used to you hitting 360, 370. So, yeah.
I would have been fine if it was 310, but I was, 260, 270, for most of the season battling back to get to, 290. So yeah, it was some tough years of just struggling and trying to get back into that good form.
All right. So after the 99 season, free agent, and you signed with the Seattle Mariners. And I came over in 01 where we became teammates. You win all three of your gold gloves in Seattle. Man, those were some fun times. And I just have nothing but fond memories there. from Lou to Ichiro's, maiden voyage to Mike Cameron to Gar to all the boys. I mean, and I could tell Johnny, you had a lot of fun in your time in Seattle. You came back home where it all started, Seattle, Washington, Bellevue. How were those years for you? And touch on, if you will, the flipping the switch story out of Lou Piniella when he gave us that rah-rah shish-kumba talk in spring training. That's still one of my favorites.
I would say coming to Seattle, it was great to have an opportunity to come back home because, you know how it is. Just because you want to go home doesn't mean there's a spot for you, at home. You could have somebody that's, there for, free agent or whatever. So, it was really hard to leave New York. I don't think I would have left New York if it wasn't for Seattle coming, to try to get me. So it was a super tough decision because I love New York. But I made the decision to come back to Seattle. My son Garrett was just born back in New York. So to have him closer to grandparents and that sort of thing definitely kind of pushed things over the edge for me to go back to Seattle. We had so much fun. I had so much fun in Seattle, and just the good quality guys in Seattle. The sense of humor that people had was outstanding. But yeah, the flip of switch. I remember that in 2001. We're just having a normal spring training. It seems like where everybody's getting ready, trying to get ready for the season. And I remember having a meeting that last week of the season or the last week of spring, and Lou is getting frustrated with us and kind of airing us out saying, hey, we got to get going. We got to get going because you can't just flip a switch and start winning ball games. And so I think I remember that, we start the season and we just went off on a tear, like I've never been on a tear. Like, nobody's ever been on. I think we were like, 19-3, after the first 3 weeks of the season. And that's when it hit me that Lou's comment that, guys, you can't just flip the switch, because we were just very mediocre in spring. And then all of a sudden, we just couldn't lose. So, yeah, it was what an interesting year that was.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Okay. Well, I think we win 20 games in April. We win 20 games in May. We go to the break, you know, on pace to win 120 games. And we're just looking around at it. I remember that year. I mean, and when people asked me about it, the 116 win season, I said, I can't explain it to you, because I was never a believer in karma or you know, clubhouse presence and everybody getting along. I always believed in you get the best talent and you steamroll people. Well, it changed after that year. There was something about that year, that group of guys.
Yeah.
We just look at each other like, you know, it'd be 7-5 in the seventh inning. We'd be losing. And we just kind of look at each other.
Yeah.
We knew we were going to come back and win. We didn't have to say anything. It wasn't an arrogant group of guys. We just knew. It was like the known thing. I'd give you a look and a head shake, and you look back like, yeah, I know what's about to happen. And it was just one of those magical years that you didn't want to ask questions. Just ride the wave, you know, because as we all know, they don't happen all the time.
Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah, no, it was one of those things that, you know, for us that had played, you know, a number of seasons, you get off to a hot start. It's like, hey, let's keep it going, because you never know when it's going to turn the other way, you know, and let's just keep going. But and so many great stories on that. I remember, you know, coming back from a road trip and Lou saying, hey, optional hitting tomorrow. And us looking at each other like, optional hitting? I've never heard of that. You know, I mean, you always take batting practice, and then we'd still go out and score 9-10 runs the next day. So, and then he'd come in the next day and go, you know what? Optional hitting tomorrow too. This is the second day of a homestand. You know, I can understand you wanting people to get rest, but not the second day. And it still worked, you know, we still go out and win a game. So yeah, I remember telling Dano, what's going on here? You know, what are we going to do? Try throwing our jocks out on the field and seeing if that works, because everything, you know, everything, we're breaking all the rules on winning ball games here.
It was unbelievable. And I remember talking to the press, because I had played for Lou as a young player. I came up to the big leagues in 92 with the Mariners. 2001 obviously was my second stint with the Mariners, but I played for Lou in 93, and I was, it seemed, you know, me at 22 years old with Lou, we just were oil. I mean, we'd be at each other's throat. He'd be yelling at me, you young rookie, you've got to do this. You got to do this. So we had a different relationship than we did my second time around. And now to this day, probably my favorite manager I ever played for. But I remember the press coming to me and saying, Booney, you know, compared to your first time around, Lou's really, you know, matured as a manager. He's really mellowed out. And I would look at these reporters like they had three heads, like, he wins every single night. How can you not? If you can't be mellow here,
he better be in a good mood.
Yeah. I mean, every night. What an awesome, awesome year.
Yeah.
So moving on, you're getting to the end of your career. In 2004, you leave the Mariners late in the season, and you go play for the Yankees. And I think you had an opportunity, and just to show how much the city of Seattle and the Mariners fans appreciated you, you came back to Seattle, and you had – tell me about the ovation you got when you come back first time as an opponent after your Seattle run.
Yeah, no, I come back with the Yankees, and my first at bat, I believe Moyer's pitching, and I walk up there and I get ready to step in the box, and Dan calls timeout to go talk to Moyer. So that the fans could give me an ovation, and the fans did. The fans gave me a great standing ovation, and you know, it was a great feeling, because I you know, the year before that, or you know, earlier in the year, 2004 was just a tough year for the team, and you know, as much as we couldn't do anything wrong in 2001. It seemed like 2004, we couldn't do anything right. And If ever there's a an opportunity for people to lose their patience with you and boo you, that was a year for me. But the fans really treated me great, and it was a great feeling to get that kind of ovation after the tough year that it had been, and being with, you know, the Yankees, who, you know, everybody here in Seattle has a bad taste in their mouth about the Yankees and beating us in 2001.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome, and I remember that ovation. Okay, so you go, you're hitting all the big franchises late in your career. So in 2005, you play for the Boston Red Sox. And this is the time I got to finally rib you a little bit. I remember I was with the Mariners. We came to town to play the Red Sox. And we have dinner. I forget if it was a dinner or I just met you after the game to just kind of catch up.
Yeah.
And at sometime in 2005, you went to the minor leagues, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I remember saying to you, Johnny, you did it in complete reverse. You never went to the minor leagues. And then you played your whole career, had a tremendous career, batting titles, gold gloves, all-star, World Series champions. And you decide to go to the minor leagues at the end of your career. Do you remember that? Right. Do you remember that meeting we had?
Yeah. No, and it's true. You know, I had a Liz Frank injury on my foot, fracture dislocation of my foot in game three of the playoffs with the Yankees the year before. And so I had surgery, had a couple of screws put in my foot, and I wasn't ready come spring training. And with the Yankees, you know, they don't say, you know, I say, well, I think I'm going to be ready at spring training. And well, with the Yankees, they can go get whoever they need, and they want a sure thing. So the Yankees didn't sign me back. So I'm trying to get back in shape. I'm not ready come the start of spring training. I'm working out in Arizona. And so finally I'm back. I feel like I'm ready. The Red Sox, they've been following me to see if I'm, you know, able to play. So they have me come to their Long A or spring training club so that they could take a look at me. And I'm trying to impress them, you know, how are you running? Let's see, single, double. All right, now score from second. And I pull my hammy trying to score from second on on one of the deals. So now I got to rehab a hamstring. And so now I'm in the spring training facility down there rehabbing a hamstring. And then they, when I was ready to go, they have me go play with the, I played for Norfolk. So no, I played for Pawtucket. But I remembered I had a series in Norfolk. So, and then from Norfolk, I got called up to the big leagues from there. So got my first minor league home run at the age of 36. So,
in the year that you
a long time coming.
In the year you end up retiring from the game. So after that 05 season, you retire. Since then, and this is what I was before we did this podcast, I was looking at some things, and this is what's impressive to me. Well, you're a Canadian. You get inducted in the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. But I was looking at it, and a couple years ago it came out. They had a Pac-10 All-Century team. And at each position, they list two or three or four guys. I snuck in on the USC side. But then I was reading further. You were on the team, but you were a little different. John Olerud is the player of the century in the I don't know if it's Pac-12 or the Pac-10. Pretty much in the history of that college division, you are named the player of the century. So essentially, you're the greatest player in the history of that thing. I thought that was a pretty awesome honor. And as much as we goof around about stuff like that, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, amazing. It's hard to believe, you know, when you think of all the great players that have gone through the Pac Pac-12 now. It's hard to believe. And I can promise you, I don't know anybody on the selection committee or anything like that.
But you kind of deserve it.
It is. It's a huge honor and hard to believe for sure.
All right. Before I let you go, I got one more question. Give me an update on the backpack. All right. Big Rude, he's famous for coming in like a school kid when he comes to the ballpark every day. He's got his backpack.
Yeah.
No one ever knew what was in that thing, but are we still rocking it?
No, it got retired. At some point, a 1990s backpack, just doesn't fit in anymore. My wife said, you got to let that thing go. But, I got it because Robin Ventura, he had it in 1999. And so he got me one. He was, have his drinks, his pack up the backpack for the spring training trip. And so he got me one. So I started wearing it. But man, did I get a lot of grief in Seattle for that. Guys were saying, what's in that backpack? You look like you could be the Unabomber. You always gotta keep your eye out for the quiet guy, because that's when somebody could snap. And so, I'd be struggling at the plate and somebody would be saying something about, hey, I'm a little worried about what's in the backpack. You're struggling. So guys had fun giving me a hard time about that.
Well, Johnny, I just want to tell you, true pleasure knowing you, true pleasure being a teammate of yours. I think I opened up the program. Just what a great guy. You've had a big impact on my life. I appreciate you coming on the Boone Podcast. And what we do here at the end of the Boone Podcast, we bring in the voice, Dan Levy, to ask a question from the fans. Danny.
Hello, fellas. How are you?
Like a fine wine.
Ah, so you're aging well. All right, here's the question. John, could you have made it as a pitcher in the big leagues, and did you ever ask to pitch one inning? That's from Jim in Spokane.
Oh, good question. I don't think so. I still remember I did do some pitching in instructional league right after I signed, and I thought I did all right, but the pitching coach, he'd look at me and he'd say, here, hold the ball this way, and would try to, find to see if I could have some natural sink, because I didn't have overpowering stuff. So, I still remember Gene Tennis, every time, my pitching was brought up, he would just start laughing, because he remembered me, down in, instructional ball. But, I think I went the right direction. I don't think I would have held up as well as a pitcher, and I didn't have good enough movement on my pitches to have a lot of success, I don't think.
John LaRude, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We appreciate it.
I had so much fun with you, and really appreciate you.
Mailbag.
All right, Boone, you know that sound. It is time to dip into the Brett Boone mailbag. Ready to rock?
It is mailbag time.
Let's do it. All right, this one comes from Chris in Reno. Brett, did you ever wear your pants to show your socks like the old school days?
I think I did. College, I wore my socks up. Pro ball, and it was different for us because I came up in the stirrup era. Nowadays, people don't really wear their sock. They just either really low, really high, and it's a one sock deal. Back when I was coming up, it was the full-on sanitaries that you wear underneath and a stirrup. Definitely wore those early in my career, my years in Cincinnati. Never wore them. Never wore the pant leg high, just down close to the shoe, but I showed stirrup, so I did it a little bit. The only time I'd bring them up high by your knees, the way you see some guys wearing them, it wasn't a good sign, because if I was wearing them high, I was really having a tough time at the plate, and I was trying to do anything to get some hits. So, no, I always liked the pants low.
All right. There's your question, good old Chris. Let's go back into the mailbag. All right, Brett, this one comes from Big Ron in Houston, and he wants to know, what's the most awkward moment that a fan has ever come up to you and asked you for an autograph?
Oh, Ron, let's see. Awkward. I don't necessarily think awkward, because I always I feel as if being a player, there's certain responsibility that comes along with being a big league player and being in the spotlight. Earning the living that you're able to earn. I think you have an obligation to the fans. And that doesn't mean I owe you anything, but I went out of my way whenever I could. If I felt like I could make even the tiniest difference in somebody's day, I always enjoyed, obviously the kids first. You know, that kid with his Little League glove. Those were my favorite. But I always went out of my way. I did as much as I could signing. But the only pet peeve I have is I'd be eating dinner with my family and somebody would come up and say, I really hate to bother you, sir. And after a while, I started saying, obviously, you don't really hate to or you wouldn't. The only thing I didn't like is when I was like actually like physically eating dinner. It bothered me. Like, come on, any other time, get me on the way to the car, on the way in. So I wouldn't necessarily say awkward, but just kind of a little bit of a pet peeve. I usually ended up signing it anyway, but reluctantly. You know, at this stage of my life, I've been there. I've lived such an unbelievable life. You learn to appreciate that. And nowadays, walking around town, you see somebody, usually they just want to shake your hand. But if somebody asks you for an autograph, I look at it more of a, I don't know. It's just somebody say that they appreciated what you did and you impacted them, even if it's in a small way.
All right. And one more bonus question. You ready? Mm-hmm. This one comes from Dan in Chicago, and he wants to know this. What did you ever do when you're in the middle of a game and you're sitting there on the field waiting for the game to kind of move along, and all of a sudden you realize you probably ate something you shouldn't have and you got to go to the bathroom? What does an athlete do? That's from Dan in Chicago, by the way.
It's mid-inning?
Mid-inning.
I don't think it's ever happened.
Really?
I don't think it's ever happened. And if it did, I don't think I've ever seen it happen to anybody. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just a time where, you know, nature calls, but you've got to find a way. It's like when you're on the freeway and you can't get off the freeway and you got to take a leak, and it just that pain of, and as you get closer to the bathroom, it just gets more severe and more severe. It's just one of those things where you got to tough it out and wait till you get that third out. And get in and do what you got to do.
2400 Sports is an Odyssey company.